This is Brian Cambria with news for the Western Slope, Monday, May 13, 2013. The Denver Post reports that an environmental foundation controlled by employees of Aspen Skiing Company gave a $50,000 grant to three organizations fighting to prevent gas drilling in Thompson Divide. The grant was the largest in the 16-year history of SkiCo's Environment Foundation. It was split among Wilderness Workshop, Thompson Divide Coalition, and EcoFlight. Matthew Hamilton, executive director of the foundation, said the board of directors of the Environment Foundation feel this is a crucial time in the effort to preserve the 220,000 acres of public lands in Thompson Divide. So it sought ways to best utilize the money available and move the needle on the issue. Earlier this year, an analysis by the Aspen Times of the grants awarded by the Environment Foundation showed at least $300,000 had been given over the last decade to protect parts of Colorado from oil and gas development. The foundation has another $92,000 in grants to organizations or efforts to promote alternative energy and climate policy that reduces greenhouse gas emissions. They've given another $92,000. Hamilton says the grants are typically given in smaller amounts than those awarded to the conservation groups this spring. The Grand Junction Daily Sentinel reports that after years of seeing the state's black bear population grow amidst the chorus of complaints from hunters, livestock growers, and farmers, Colorado Parks and Wildlife is set to reverse that growth. Bear licenses for the six game management units on Grand Mesa have been increased from 480 in 2012 to 1,000 this year in response to the growing numbers. Several years of black bear research are saying the state's bear population is substantially higher than previous estimates, something ranchers have been saying for years. Wildlife Commissioner Robert Bray, a rancher from Nucla, said, quote, "In my country, there's a bear behind every bush. It's ridiculous, and we have to do something," end quote. Jerry Apker, state carnivore biologist for Parks and Wildlife, told the Parks and Wildlife Commission on Thursday that bear licenses this year are up 210% since 2010. "Our harvest is up 58% and the mortality is up 60%, Apker said, adding both are indicative of a healthy bear population. Parks and Wildlife Northwest Region Manager Ron Velarde said the agency is going to change course in bear management, saying, "We are concerned about human health and safety, increased conflicts with human and livestock, and predation." Areas where bear conflicts are common, such as the Roaring Fork Valley, have been under siege in recent years. Earlier this month, wildlife officers trapped a large housebreaking bear in Aspen. The bear's size was estimated at 500 pounds. On Saturday, the Delta Historical Museum hosted a tribute to two sisters for their many contributions to the community. KVNF's Marty Derlin reports.
Since 1932, Nellie Clark and Sula Matthews have lived in Delta, where they've given a lifetime of community service at the library, the schools, the church, and a variety of other worthy causes. This week, Nellie turns 97. Her younger sister is only 89. The sisters married and had families, but their husbands are now dead and most of the kids moved away. So the two decided to live together in a house designed by Nellie to accommodate their diverse interests. They each have a separate apartment, including kitchens and sitting rooms, but they share a living room and a deck looking out toward Grand Mesa. The unique arrangement has allowed them to get along together for more than 20 years, as Sula explains.
"The reason we live the way we do is because she's a perfectionist and I'm not. And I always had my things the way I wanted them, and she had hers. And it's worked well till I got so I had to have help. And so when she started helping me, she just thinks her way. And that's why we were living different, so we'd never go through this." And so we both grit our teeth and try to do the best for each other.
Nellie's four daughters and Sula's daughter and son attended the event. Jim Matthews remembered his mom and aunt's long history of trying to improve things.
I remember as a little kid, they were in a group called the BBC Club, Build a Better Community Club, and that they started. So as long as I remember, they've been doing stuff for the community.
Nellie talked to a friend about the volunteer work she still does at Delta Memorial Hospital.
I fell and I broke some bones in my back, and I hadn't gone back. Well, I couldn't get up and down much, but I've gone back the last 3 weeks. I found me a spot that wasn't very hard work.
Do you still walk out there?
Uh-huh.
Do you? I seen you out there one day. I went out, and I seen you go out the front door, and they had your little cart behind you, and where you went.
It's got one wheel, must be wrong, because it won't go straight. It goes this way or that way. And so you have to allow for it. When you push it to go in a straight line, you have to push it crooked.
Trying to go straight by pushing it crooked. I'm Marty Derland for KVNF News.
The Denver Post reports that the federal government has approved Utah to become the first state to have a dual-model health insurance exchange in which the state and the federal government divide responsibilities. The plan allows Utah to continue to run its existing health insurance marketplace for small businesses, a system that lets employees pick health care plans in an online exchange. The federal government will run the state's individual exchange. The two marketplaces will operate independently of each other. Governor Gary Herbert first requested this arrangement in February, and the two sides had been negotiating since. Other states will have the option to consider this model after the U.S. Health and Human Services approves an official rule allowing Utah's deal to go forward. Herbert said in a conference call with media Friday that it was an important and historic day for Utah. He emphasized that the state didn't back down in negotiations. For example, he said, Utah made sure the government knew it would not share information about its residents or businesses with a federal database. Quoting Herbert, "They've granted us everything that we asked for, and for that I'm grateful." He applauded Health and Human Services Secretary Karen Sebelius for her willingness to work with Utah in crafting a plan that works for both sides. A few weeks ago on the IC Change Report, we covered the story of orchardist Will Beasley's journals from the 1930s, 40s, and 50s that are being transcribed on thealmanac.org by local farmer Amber Kleinman. Through reading the journals, Kleinman not only learned about historical farming and weather in the North Fork, but also caught a glimpse of Will Beasley's life. Now, that life has been further illuminated by Beasley's grandnephew, Larry Beasley. KVNF's Marty Derland has more.
Turns out Will Beasley had an identical twin brother, John, and together they owned about 150 acres up Stevens Gulch, running down to the river and up to the top of Pitkin Mesa. Much of the land was in orchards, and the twins were busy all year long, hauling rock, chasing water, pruning trees. Will lived at the top of the mesa in a house on what is now called Swanson Road. John lived on the other side of the gulch in a house near what is now called Highway 33. In April, Amber Kleinman, Andrea Likos, and I visited John's grandson, Larry Beasley, who lives on the old homestead. And after showing us photos of John and Will, posing in identical cowboy gear as mirror images of each other, Larry took us on a tour of the property and talked about the twins who were born in 1878.
Well, they were close. They each worked each other's place almost every day they got together. And if they didn't get together, they talked on the phone. Granddad died in 1945, and Uncle Will said to my dad, he said, "I've just lost my best friend." So it was that same year then that he sold his place up on the mesa there, and he moved into this cabin. And his wife, Wealtha, had died in 1937, and he never remarried. So he just lived by himself very simply in this cabin.
The cabin is small and presently used as storage, but Larry Beasley remembers the place in the days after his granddad died and Will came to live there.
He had a radio with a homemade wooden box around it, and it was sitting right here, and he'd listen to the weather every day. And then he ate here. He ate oatmeal every morning. No sweetener, no milk, just old-fashioned oatmeal and salt.
The weather dominates Will's journal entries. He often uses something called Pilot's Knob as a reference point. Amber asked about the landmark.
He refers to Pilot's Knob, especially when there's weather.
I think it's that thing you can see between Coal Mountain and Gunnison.
Oh, the little bump again.
Yeah. They would also pay attention to where the sun rose, like if it was between Coal Mountain and Pilot Knob, or between Pilot Knob and Gunnison, or between Gunnison and Jumbo,
right.
Elephant's Back, which from here, that's pretty much, you know, where you would see it.
Amber and Andrea were curious about the practice of planting by the moon or using other astrological information in farming.
There was one example I can think of. My dad said that his dad told him that if you wanted to kill a tree, you would, of course, you know, you'd girdle it. You'd cut the bark all the way around the cambium layer, and you would do that in the dark of the moon in August. You wanted to make sure to kill the tree. Yeah, Chinese elm?
Yeah.
In fact, there was a Chinese elm tree right about here.
Oh,
and I killed it with that method.
Huh.
Our tour included many antique items and stories about the old days. One of the themes Amber noticed in her reading of the journals was Will's love of dancing. Larry Beasley confirmed that. Will knew how to have a good time, and in the days before John died, the twins liked to drink whiskey and go to dances together.
They had gone to a dance once, and some woman who had also had a lot to drink came up and said, and she had a butcher knife in her hand, she said, "I'm going to earmark one of you so I know, so I can tell you apart." And she actually did cut a little crescent moon shape out of one of them's ear. I think it was Uncle Will.
For KVNF News, thinking about the wild old days, I'm Marty Derlin.
I don't think we have dances like that around here. Now, this past week, June and Dallas Harding reported they got almost 2 inches of rain up on Minnesota Creek, plus some good news, bad news. The cool, wet weather means they haven't had to irrigate yet. However, the grass is not growing too fast, so they are using more hay. I See Change at KVNF is a public media experiment that fosters multimedia conversations between citizens and scientists about how seasonal changes in the weather and climate extremes affect daily American life. I See Change is a part of Localore, a nationwide production of AIR, the Association of Independents in Radio. The I See Change Almanac is your gateway to join the conversation and be a part of two-way radio. The I See Change Almanac seeks to provide communities that depend on nature a dynamic, crowdsourced reservoir of information to help them navigate decision-making in the context of climate extremes. Check it out at thealmanac.org and be a part of it. Be a part of two-way radio. Thus concludes today's newscast. For KVNF News, I'm Brian Cambria. Good day.